Lou Holtz had vast experience before moving to South Bend and the Golden Dome of the University of Notre Dame. He'd been coach of William & Mary, North Carolina State, Arkansas, and Minnesota. He was also the coach for one season of the New York Jets. His record at all of the schools has been one of consistent success. Four of his Arkansas teams ranked in the top 10. In his career, he's had many significant victories, but perhaps one of his biggest wins was in the Orange Bowl game, upsetting the University of Oklahoma Sooners. Going into the game, his Arkansas team was a 20-point underdog. They were also playing without four of the team's top stars. Yet Arkansas soundly defeated the Oklahoma Sooners 31-6. Coach Holtz has led his teams to over 200 victories and more than 20 bowl games. And he's been named the National Coach of the Year twice. His Fighting Irish have also won the national championship after an undefeated season, and Lou is 12th all-time on the NCAA career victories list. Lou is a master entertainer, an outstanding sleight-of-hand performer, and best of all, he's one of the country's finest motivational speakers. It is a pleasure to introduce to you Coach Lou Holtz.
Greetings, this is Lou Holtz, head football coach of the University of Notre Dame. Every successful person I've ever known has gotten up off the ground after he's been knocked down. Everybody gets discouraged from time to time. The thing that separates the average individual from the great one is that the great one will continue to get up off the ground. The best football players I've ever coached was probably Billy Ray Smith or Dan Hampton. Both of them now are playing the Professional Football League. They aren't great football players because they never got knocked down. They're great football players because they refused to stay down. You knock them down, they get up, took the shortest route to the ball carrier, and arrived there in a bad mood. Regardless of the field of profession you may be in, you have to understand that if you're going to be successful, you're going to have to overcome adversity. The successful person is the one that sees an opportunity in every problem, whereas the individual that never does achieve success is normally going to find a problem with every opportunity. It's difficult to build a successful life, a successful business, a successful family. But it's all based on overcoming adversity. The poem, it says, I saw a group of men in my hometown. I saw a group of men tearing a building down. With a heave and a hoe and a mighty yell, they swung a beam and the sidewall fell. And I said to the foreman, are these men skilled? The type you'd hire if you wanted to build? And he laughed and said, why, no, indeed. Common labor's all I need. For I can tear down in a day or two what it takes a builder 10 years to do. And I thought to myself as I walked away, which of these roles do I wish to play? Am I the type that's going to build a successful life day after day by overcoming the adversity that's going to enter my life? I thought John F. Kennedy made an awful lot of great comments during the course of his life, but perhaps the one I enjoy the most was when they asked him in 1960 if he would accept the vice presidency of the United States because he's young and he was a Catholic. He said no. He said once you accept second place when first is available, you have a tendency to do it the rest of your life. I think this is really true with all of us. I don't ask our athletes how many of them want to win. Everybody wants to win when the band's playing, the crowd's cheering, the TV lights are on. But the question I ask, can you live with losing? Can you live with failure? Can you live with mediocrity? I'll never forget when I first went to North Carolina State University in the year 1972. We opened up with a very fine football team from Syracuse. At that time, Ben Schwartzwalder had assembled an outstanding group of athletes, and North Carolina State entered the game a 23-point underdog. We were fortunate enough to win the football game 43-21. And as the seconds ticked off 3-2-1, the players picked me up on the shoulder, carried me in the middle of the field triumphantly, and dropped me. I shook Ben Schwartzwalder's hand, sprinted into the locker room. And upon my arrival there, I saw the wildest celebration I've ever seen a team put on. I happened to be at Ohio State University in 1968 under Woody Hayes when we won the national championship. But never once did I see a group of young men celebrate a victory as much as our North Carolina State players did that one. After we said our prayer and things calmed down, I merely said to the football players, nothing's as good as it seems, and nothing's as bad, but somewhere in between, reality falls. The very next week, we went over and played a very good University of North Carolina football team. We lost one of the most heartbreaking defeats I've ever been associated with. We lost by a score of 35-34 when we failed on a two-point conversion with 8 seconds to go. As we walked off the field, I was very, very depressed. walked into the locker room, the same football team which 1 week before, 7 days before, had celebrated so wildly, now was the most depressed football team I've ever witnessed. After we said our prayer, the only thing I could think to say to them was exactly the same comment I had made 1 week previously. I said, nothing's as good as it seems, nothing's as bad as it seems, but somewhere in between their reality falls. I don't care how tough the situation you face from time to time, I'm sure if we're honest with ourselves and reflect back upon it, we'll realize that we've been in more difficult situations previously. In coaching, you have ups and you have downs, but the great ones are the ones that bounce back. When I was at the University of Arkansas, I jokingly say that after we beat Oklahoma in the Orange Bowl, the fans made a commemorative stamp to honor Lou Holtz. However, after we lost to Texas, they had to do away with the stamp because people kept spitting on the wrong side. You have to understand that defeat is not fatal, nor is victory ever final. Let's look at some of the individuals that have really achieved things in life after overcoming tremendous odds or obstacles. When Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, he did so after almost 10,000 unsuccessful experiments. When Marconi came out and said, I have the theory that enables man to transmit sound through space, they committed him to the insane asylum. Or let's look at O.J. Simpson. Not many people realize it, but all through high school, O.J. Simpson was a defensive tackle. He went into junior college, and once again, they put him at the position of defensive tackle. Now, you and I both know there's not a great future for an individual who's 6 feet two, 205 pounds, and plays defensive tackle. But O.J. Simpson hung in there when most people would have become discouraged and quit. Finally, his second year in junior college, they moved O.J. Simpson to a running back, and the rest is history. He not only played for Southern Cal and won the Heisman Award, he also went on to the Professional Football League and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. During that induction ceremony, there was another individual that was honored as well, an individual by the name of Roger Staubach. Not many people are aware of the fact that when Roger Staubach got out of high school, that he only had one scholarship offer, and that was to the United States Naval Academy. He was not highly recruited. He wished to go to the Naval Academy, as I said, because that's the only school that really offered him a scholarship, but he had a deficiency in math and consequently had to go to the New Mexico Military Institute to prep for a year. Upon his arrival in Annapolis, nobody heralded him as the next great quarterback or the individual that would win the Heisman Award. All certainly they were glad to see Roger Staubach because he was a class individual, a fine athlete, but in all probability most people felt he would end up in the defensive secondary. But lo and behold, Roger Staubach went on to win the Heisman Award. But unfortunately, like most many great athletes, he could not go into professional football. Because, you see, Roger Staubach was faced with a 5-year commitment to the United States Navy. Gil Brand of the Dallas Cowboys is a good friend of mine, and I used to go out and watch them practice every year. Roger Staubach spent 11 months on active duty. And the 1 month furlough he spent at Thousand Oaks with the Dallas Cowboys training. Finally, Roger Staubach became a rookie in the NFL at the tender age of almost 29. Roger Staubach did not even become a starter in the NFL till past the age 30. And once again, I reflect back and think, how many people would have given up at age 29 or 30 and say, oh, I couldn't make it. I've been away from football for 5 or 6 years. But that's the thing that differentiates the average person from the great one, is perseverance, hanging in there and getting things done. I think we all realize that in the field of business, we're successful because we help people get what they want. We don't sell anything in this world. You find a problem, you solve it. You find a void, you fill it. You look at almost any organization that's successful today, regardless of the field of endeavor, they're successful because they help people get what they want. You must provide need or service if you're going to be successful. I had a great experience when I was an assistant football coach at the College of William & Mary. It was a 9-month-a-year job, which meant 3 months out of the year I had to get a job in order to support my family. The job I got was selling cemetery plots. As I say, I don't know how difficult your job is, but I've never had one any more difficult in my entire life. My wife is usually very, very supportive of me, and I might pause here and say I not only love her dearly, but she also happens to be my best friend. But in this particular instance, she became negative. She said, you're going to sell what? To who? She said, you won't sell anything. Well, I've never been more motivated in my entire life than I was that summer. And I not only sold our car, our stereo, our TV, I also sold our radio. In other words, I was a complete failure as a salesman. Finally, the latter part of the summer, they sent me to a 2-day seminar in Richmond, Virginia. The first day I learned very little. The second day a guy got up and said, I have a simple philosophy of life. I don't mind telling you, I'm not very smart, and I've got to keep things rather simple. So I paid close attention. He said, you don't sell anything. You help people get what they want. You, in turn, will get anything you want. You look at the top 25 businesses in the country in the year 1900 and compare them with the top 25 businesses in the country today. You will find that two are still ranked among the top 25. Two have gone bankrupt. Six others have merged with other organizations. And the rest of those on the list have dwindled down. Why? Because basically we forget the philosophy of helping people get what they want. People were so busy running the railroad in 1930 they went bankrupt. Their job wasn't to run the railroad. Their job was to transport people from one location to another. When we go recruiting, we don't tell an athlete what he can do for us. We tell an athlete what we can do for him. How we can develop his skills, his talents, abilities, put him in a discipline program, but most importantly, help him get a college education. To me, that is what recruiting is all about. Every time we've tried to sell an athlete on what he can do for us, we have usually failed. I think it's exceptionally important for people to dream big. If you're going to overcome adversity and get up off the ground, you have to have dreams that truly motivate you. In the year 1966, I'd just been at South Carolina approximately 1 month under Marvin Bass when he resigned. They then hired Paul Dietzel, who came in and completely renovated the staff. At that time, I happened to be 26 years of age. My wife was 8 months pregnant with our third child. We had just spent every cent we had in the bank for a down payment on the home, and I had to come home and tell my wife I'd been relieved of my job and consequently did not have much income in the near future. It was at that time we talked about our life and what we should do, and I started reading books. The only thing that's going to change you from where you are today and to where you're going to be 5 years from now are the books you read, the people you meet, and the tapes you listen to. I started reading various books on motivation. Everybody talked about goals and dreams and ambitions. It was at that time I sat down and made a list of all the things I would like to do in this world. The list completely totaled 107. I'm happy to say that we've achieved approximately 78 of those dreams or goals at the present time. Some of them were stupid. I wanted to play the 50 greatest golf courses in the world. I wanted to be on the Tonight Show. I wanted to learn how to do magic. Some of them were very ambitious. We've won the national championship. I wanted to be coach of the year. I wanted to see the Pope. I wanted to go to the White House for dinner, etc. There are many dreams on that list that we have not achieved thus far. I've never floated to Snake River. But it's dreams that really cause you to get up in the morning and go do the things that an average person doesn't want to do because an average person is basically lazy. You show me somebody's bored with life, I'll show you somebody that doesn't have an awful lot of dreams or hopes or ambitions. Can you imagine walking up to Sir Edmund after he scaled Mount Everest and say, how'd you get here? And he said, I don't know. I went for a walk, and here I am. They tell the story about the guy that was in the Army. He'd been on KP duty for approximately 13 hours. He came back, and they said, hey, John, let's go dance with the Fräulein, drink some beer, and eat some pizza. He said, no, man, I'm too tired. All I want to do is lay down here on the bed. As he lay down on the bed, he noticed there was a letter there that arrived from his girl. He quickly opened up the letter, and he started to read. The contents of the letter said, Dear John, if I could just gaze into those big, beautiful, crystal blue eyes of yours one more time, if I could feel your strong masculine arms embrace me one more time, if I could hear your sweet, tender voice, witness your bubbling personality, your magnetic charisma, I know I could continue to be true, but... All of a sudden, John wasn't tired. He got up off that bed, went running off the military post, doing 100 and about 9.2. The guy on guard duty saw him coming, took the M14 rifle, aimed it at John's jugular vein and said, Halter, I'm going to shoot. And John never even broke stride. The last words he ever uttered were these. He said, my mother's in heaven, my father's in hell, my girl's in Chicago, and I'm going to see one of them tonight. If we could get a group of athletes to feel that strongly about a cause, that would be willing to get up when things don't look good, then success would be guaranteed. I think that self-image is so important in getting up off the ground. There's a little card on my desk which says, Perseverance. You just have to continue to persevere when things look the darkest. One of the reasons that people do not persevere when success may be just around the corner is because they doubt their abilities to be successful. You show me an individual that lacks self-confidence, and I'll show you somebody that's petty, that's jealous. They'll consistently try to pull other people down so they'll look better by comparison. I used to be very petty and very jealous myself. I used to be insanely jealous of my wife, and yet never once has my wife given me ample reason to be jealous ever. The problem wasn't with my wife, the problem was with me. I didn't like myself, I didn't see how anybody else could possibly like me. I just looked at the strong assets of other people and the negative things about my personality or about my appearance or about my talents and abilities. See, self-image does not come from looks, does not come from intelligence. Self-image comes when you ask yourself, am I doing what's right? Am I doing the best I can? And am I treating other people as I would like to be treated? Let's go back to the first comment I made, am I doing what's right? I feel one of the things that's the most derogatory towards our self-image is things such as pornography. When we get involved doing things that we know in our own heart and our own soul is not the proper thing to do, then we naturally have a tendency to feel that we aren't very worthwhile. We get a guilty complex and feel, well, we really, truly don't deserve to enjoy success. That's why I always find the best way to get up off the ground and raise your self-image is to have a little consultation with yourself and make sure you're doing what's right. The second thing, am I doing the best I can? More people aren't good disciplinarians with their children or with their employees because they feel they have to have the acceptance of these people in order to feel good about themselves. It's the insecure parent. It's the insecure boss that will not provide the proper leadership and insist, demand, and lead people to the fact that they must do the best they're capable of doing. When we feel best about ourselves and we go home at night, tired, worn out, exhausted, and as we put our head on the pillow, we say, well, I did the best I could. I just put it in somebody else's hands, but if I keep doing the best I can, I know that success is inevitable. And the third thing about treating other people as you would like to be treated. Oh, we can win with intimidation. We can win because we have the power. We can win because we're going to dominate people, but you and I both know, unless we base our lives on treating other people as we'd like to be treated, it is strictly a matter of time before we face failure. I never forget that approximately 7 years ago I had to make a speech at O'Hare Hilton. I arrived there the preceding evening at approximately 1:30 in the morning. I walked up to the man behind the desk and said, my name's Lou Holtz and I have reservations and I'd like my key immediately. Well, after he fumbled around a while, he said he couldn't really find it and it'd take him a few minutes, and I told him that he'd better find it now because I wasn't fixing to wait a few minutes, that I was tired, it had been a long, hard day, and I wanted action immediately. He said, well, you may not be staying here tonight. And I said, sir, you don't understand. I have a confirmation slip right in my hand. He looked at me and he said, you don't understand. I have the keys in my hand, and I'm not fixing to give you one tonight. It was obvious he had won the argument because he did have the keys. Finally, at approximately 1:35 at night, when it was obvious that I wasn't going to be able to spend the evening there, I had to go find another motel to spend the night. As I walked across the lobby, I made a vow to myself at that time. I said, Lou Holtz, he won the argument. He had the keys. He intimidated me. But I said, never again will you have an opportunity to speak to a prominent, successful group, such as we have assembled here listening this tape, that you do not take the opportunity to knock the O'Hare Hilton. And over the past 6 years, I will say this, I have knocked the O'Hare Hilton. The point I make out of this is that even though you can win with intimidation, that unless you treat other people as you'd like to be treated, it will come back to haunt you several times. I often think how many times I've won an argument with intimidation, offended somebody else, and do not know the irreparable damage that he may be doing to our school, our university, or our team without my knowledge. We're always going to have difficult things go against us. Whenever we have failure, the first thing that happens to us is we have a tendency to get away from fundamentals. There are fundamentals in your business the same as they are in mine. If we are not excellent in the adherence to these fundamentals, we are going to face more failures in the future. We also become exceptionally aggressive with people. And then we become insecure. We begin to worry about our job. We begin to question our talents and our abilities. Then we become very lonely. We don't want to go around people. We say, well, maybe this isn't my day. Maybe I made a mistake. I will just wait till tomorrow, and maybe the situation will be a little bit better. Then we become undisciplined. Discipline is one of the most important things we can possess. I do not jog, but I love and respect and admire the people that do, such as my wife. I loved what Abe Lemon said, though. They said, do you jog? And he said, oh, no, I wish to be sick when I die. I do not jog, but I think the discipline that we need in our lives is absolutely essential if we're going to be successful. Then resentment sets in our life. When things don't go well, we have a tendency to point our finger at everybody else and say, the reason I'm in my present position is because of this individual or that individual or this circumstance. Then the worst thing that happens to us when we have failure is we lose our enthusiasm. Empathy sets in. You're either going to be positive and enthusiastic about life, or you're going to sit around and be filled with self-pity. Self-pity is the greatest form of self-destruction that I presently know. The words I just talked about spell out the word failure. When things go wrong, we have a tendency to get away from fundamentals. We become aggressive with people. We become insecure. We become lonely. We become undisciplined. Resentment sets in, empathy sets in, and we lose our enthusiasm. We as individuals are very unique. We have an awful lot of powers. We have the powers to think and to love and to laugh and to create and to imagine and to plan. But the greatest power we have in this world is the power to choose. We are where we are presently today because of the choices we make. We have the power to choose whether we're going to act or procrastinate, believe or doubt, help or hinder, heal or harm. But we also have the power to succeed or failure. Our future will be ascertained by the decisions we make. And I firmly believe this in the bottom of my heart. We choose whether we're going to succeed or fail. We have a little saying on our football team that we're constantly reminding each other of. And the saying is, what are you going to do now? You just had great success. What are you going to do now? You going to rest on your laurels? Or are you going to continue to try to achieve greater things? In this world, we either get better or we get worse. We do not stay the same. And if what you did yesterday looks big to you, then you certainly haven't done much today. I love the saying, it said the good Lord put eyes in front of our head rather than back so we know where we're going rather than where we've been. What are you going to do now has a tendency to evaluate the past, but more importantly, focus on the future. You just lost a football game. You just lost a business deal. What are you going to do now? You're going to sit around and feel sorry for yourself? Are you going to do the necessary things in order to achieve greater success? Yes, we have an awful lot of powers, and we have the power to change our life. The auctioneer held up the violin by the bow, and he said, now tell me, my friends, what am I bid for the old violin, and who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, and he'll go to two, and $2 going to three, and $3 going once, going twice, and going for $3, said he. But no, from the back of the room came forward a tall gray-haired man, picked up the violin by the bow, blew the dust from it, tightened up the strings, and proceeded to play a melody so beautiful and so pure as the angels sing. And the music ceased. And the auctioneer in a low voice said, now, my friends, what am I bid for the old violin, and who'll start the bidding for me? $1,000, and he'll go to two, and $2,000 going to three, and $3,000 going once, going twice, and going for $3,000, said he. The people cheered, but some of them asked, and said, we don't quite understand. What changed the worth of the violin? And the auctioneer replied, it was a touch of a master's hand. And many of us, with our life out of tune and tethered and torn within, are auctioned cheaply to a thoughtless crowd, much like that old violin. With a glass of wine and a drink in hand, we're going once, we're going twice, we're going and going till we're almost gone. But the master comes, and a foolish crowd can never quite understand the value of a man's soul or the change that can be made by the touch of a master's hand. I have a strong faith in God. I don't want to make this a religious talk, but I don't know what the future holds, but I sure do know who holds the future. And if I pray and act and conduct myself in a proper manner and do what's right, do the best I can, and treat others as we'd like to be treated, there's no doubt that we're going to have success, regardless of the field of endeavor, regardless of the obstacles we are going to face. In order to overcome adversity, in order to get up off the ground, we have to be totally committed. And that commitment cannot be taken very lightly. What made this country truly great was a commitment to excellence. You show me a good marriage, I'll show you one where the two individuals are committed to making that marriage work out. My wife and I have been married together for 48 years. Now that may not impress you because it is 24 years apiece. That doesn't mean we've never had problems during the 24 years, but we are committed to making that marriage work out. And with a commitment, you don't look for a way out. You have problems, certainly. But whenever a problem comes along, you're busy looking for a solution. Whereas if you're not committed, the first couple problems that come along, you start looking for a way to get out of it. I think that if you're really committed, then teamwork comes about naturally. If you like yourself, you like other people. When you like other people, you try to help other people. And that's what teamwork's all about. You can take a hand with five fingers going in five different directions, and it's not very powerful. But if you bring those five fingers together and clench them and form a fist, you have a very powerful object. The difference is when everybody's working together, when everybody's on the same page, when everybody cares about one another, you have teamwork, and teamwork is automatic success. The next time you get downhearted, the next time you get truly depressed, I want you to remember a couple names. Remember a guy by the name of Jack Robertson. He came within 800 yards of swimming the English Channel. He's a 1973 graduate of my alma mater, Kent State University. You say, what's so great about that? He failed. But you have to understand that Jack Robertson's a paraplegic. Without the use of any legs, he tried to swim the English Channel, and only a strong undercurrent prohibited him from doing it successfully. But can we say an individual without the use of any legs came within 800 yards of swimming the English Channel, cannot look upon himself as having certain ingredients that are necessary for success? Or how about Peter Gray, who played outfield in the major leagues with one arm? Or Monty Stratton or Lou Brassey, who pitched in the major leagues with only one leg? Or Shelley Mann? It's my understanding that they put Shelley Mann in the water at age one in a life preserver so that the buoyancy of the water would give Shelley Mann some exercise. Because, you see, at age one, Shelley Mann was completely paralyzed. And they put Shelley Mann in the water at age one. Little did anybody realize that 15 years later, in Melbourne, Australia, Shelley Mann would win two gold medals and be declared the fastest woman swimmer in the world. Or Bobby Morrow. At age eight, Bobby Morrow was a national poster boy for polio. Pictures seen all over the country on crutches and embraces. Yet we all know the tremendous accomplishments of Bobby Morrow. Or Glenn Cunningham was burnt so bad in the fire the doctors wished to amputate his legs. But only because a mother refused to give her compliance did they not operate. The doctor said Glenn Cunningham will never walk again. Well, I don't know if he ever walked again, but one thing is certain, he sure could run. Because in 1936, in the Melrose Games in Madison Square Garden, Glenn Cunningham ran the mile in 4 minutes and 6 seconds, which at that time was unheard of. As a matter of fact, that same Glenn Cunningham was voted the athlete of the century for his great accomplishments in track. Time after time, we find people have really achieved tremendous things by overcoming great adversity. And as we sit here today in this great country, with the great opportunities we have as people, we can't help but feel the opportunities are unlimited, and we control our own destiny. When we talk about commitment, I can't help but reflect back to the year 1975 when I turned down an offer to coach the New York Jets 3 different times. Finally, on the 4th offer, I finally accepted it. I did so rather reluctantly, but I said to my wife and family, I'm not sure this is what I want to do, but let's go see what professional football is like. If we don't like professional football, we can always come back to intercollegiate athletics. Ladies and gentlemen, I went into professional football without a total commitment. I never went there and talked about winning the Super Bowl or even winning the championship. The main thought on my mind was, am I going to be happy? Am I going to like it? Consequently, every time a problem came along, I'd start looking for a way out. I'd get up every morning analyzing whether I wished to remain in professional football or not. What a disservice I did to the New York Jets. They had some beautiful owners there in Leon Hess and Mr. Isen. Nobody could have been more cooperative. Nobody could have been more willing to give us anything we needed in order to enjoy success. But I did a total disservice to that organization because I was not totally committed. Whatever you're going to do in this world, you've got to be totally committed or you have absolutely no chance for success. In 1977, we took a football team down to the Orange Bowl to play an outstanding team from Oklahoma. Unfortunately, we had a little problem and consequently had to suspend 3 athletes that scored 78% of our touchdowns. In addition to that, we lost an All-American guard with a knee injury, and we lost our captain with a broken arm. We were overwhelming underdogs, and nobody predicted that we ever had a chance to win the football game. Our football players had a rather negative attitude towards the game in itself. The reason this came about, because every time they picked up a paper, they read about the great individuals that were going to perform in the game from Oklahoma and the outstanding players from Arkansas that were not going to perform in the game. Not one time during our entire stay in Miami was there a positive article on our players that were going to play in the game. Consequently, if you keep reading about how bad you are, pretty soon you start to believe it. As we had a squad meeting and the players came in approximately 2 days before the game, you could tell they didn't believe they had a chance to win. They wouldn't look at one another, they wouldn't laugh, they just sort of sat down with their heads rather bowed. After we talked to them, I still could not get their attention, nor much response from them. I then said, we're going to go around this room, and I want each and every one of you to get up and tell me why we can win the football game. I've read all the reasons why we can't win, but what I'd like to focus on are some of the reasons why we can. I said, I just ask two things, that the comments be sincere and the comments be positive. As I get up one by one, they pointed out some very illuminating facts that most people around the country had forgotten. They pointed out we had a great defense. As a matter of fact, we were number one in the country. We had such outstanding defensive players as Dan Hampton in the defensive line. And that if we did get beat in a football game, we wouldn't get beat by the 24 to 28 points that the odds makers had predicted. Then they point out we had the best punter in the country and the best place kicker. This was true statistically. Steve Little was the best punter and best place kicker in the country, and he was going to participate in a football game for the University of Arkansas. Then Roland Sales got up. The young man had never gained 100 yards in a football game during his entire high school or college career. He pointed out that even though he hadn't carried the football much during the course of the year, he could gain 1,000 yards during the course of the season had I given him the ball enough. Not because he was a great back, but because of the outstanding line we had. Ladies and gentlemen, 2 nights later in the Orange Bowl, I've never seen a football team play together or with as much confidence as that football team did. Roland Sales rushed for an Orange Bowl record that still stands today of 206 yards. We won the football game 31-6, but it wasn't a victory for Coachy. It was a victory when a group of young men stopped looking at why they couldn't win and started focusing on why they could. So many times we let what we don't have keep us from using what we do have. It's a question whether you're going to see the glass half filled or half empty. The question is whether you've been working to fill it up or whether you've been drinking out of it. Whether you're going to be positive, you see it half filled. If you're going to be negative, you're going to see it half empty. This is Lou Holtz of Notre Dame, closing with a little poem that we say before every game. And the poem goes like this. This is the beginning of a new day. God has given me this day to use I will. I can waste or I can use it for good. What I do today is important because I'm exchanging a day out of my life for it. When tomorrow comes, this day will be gone forever, leaving in its place that which I have traded. Want it to be gained, not lost, good, not evil, success, not failure. In order that I should not regret the price I paid for it, because the future is just a whole string of nows. Thank you.
Coach Lavelle Edwards has, during his more than 25 years as head coach of Brigham Young University, totally changed the school's football image. Before Lavelle took over in 1972, BYU had won their conference championship only one time in the school's entire history. Under Lavelle, the Cougars have won more than 200 games, captured the conference championship an incredible 16 times, and competed in 19 bowl games. Lavelle is the third winningest active coach in major college football in the entire country and ranks ninth all-time in career victories. His team went undefeated in 1984, winning the national championship and awarding Lavelle National Coach of the Year honors. In addition to his remarkable coaching skills, Coach Edwards has earned his doctorate degree in education and has served as a bishop in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He now will share with you his experiences on how to build a winning tradition and how to turn problems into positive results. Coach Lavelle Edwards.
Before I became the head football coach at Brigham Young University, I worked for BYU as an assistant coach. At that time, I was also a bishop in the Mormon Church on campus. In both jobs, I counseled a lot of young people who came to me with problems. One of the first things I told them was that they were not alone with their problems. They were not the Lone Ranger. I told them we all have problems, that every situation in life has its own built-in problems. There are different kinds of problems, certainly, but without them, there would be fewer opportunities for growth. Having problems doesn't make you unique. It doesn't mean you're destined to be a loser. It's how you handle your problems that counts. Problems can overcome you, or you can overcome them. It's that simple. I've had my problems. Show me a football coach who hasn't. There were times when I thought I had more than my share. You probably have felt that way too. Maybe you feel that way now. I knew even when I was growing up that I wanted to be a coach. I never considered anything else. So I became a high school coach, and with the record that I had, I probably should have gotten out of coaching. I was a high school coach for 8 years and never had a winning season. For the first 5 of those 8 years, I coached the old single-wing formation, and we seldom, if ever, threw a pass. I believed in the old philosophy. When you throw a pass, 3 things can happen, and 2 of them are bad. In 1962, I was hired as an assistant coach at BYU. I stayed in that job for 10 years, eventually becoming the defensive coordinator. But in that time, BYU had only 4 winning seasons. We weren't going anywhere. That was the situation in 1972 when I was appointed the head football coach at BYU. There I was, 42 years old, and in 18 years of coaching, I had been associated with only 4 winning seasons. Brigham Young University had won only 1 conference championship in its history, and there was little reason to believe they would win another one soon. But I'm happy to say we turned it around. In the 14 years I've been a head coach, we've won 11 conference championships and the national championship in 1984. We've won the conference title the last 10 years in a row. How did we do it? I like to think we did it by recognizing our problems and overcoming them when possible, by actually turning them into advantages. Our first problem was attitude. We thought and acted like losers. Like most losers in life, we had built-in reasons for losing. You've heard them all before. Losers say, we're small. Our competitors are big and powerful. Our location is bad. Our building or our store isn't as nice as our competitors. We don't have the home office support, and we don't have the advertising budget. Our product won't do everything our competitors will, and so on. Losers find reasons to lose. Gradually, we changed that. We knew we had to believe in ourselves before anyone else would believe in us. We had to believe we could win where we were with what we had. We started thinking and acting like winners. We might have been kidding ourselves, but that's far better than acting like losers. Our first game in 1972 was against Kansas State. They were from the powerful Big 8 Conference. We were a decided underdog. During the week leading up to that game, I decided to form a player council. I would have each group on the team, defensive line, secondary, linebackers, offensive line, offensive back, and receivers, elect their own representatives to form the council. These 6 players, along with the 2 co-captains and myself, would be the nucleus of the council. I established guidelines under which we would operate, and we met weekly from that time on. The idea was to have better communication between the coaching staff and the team. They, in fact, would have a voice in some aspects of the team. It was also a great vehicle for me to relay to the team what was necessary for them to start thinking like winners. It was also an excellent opportunity for me to use the committee as a sounding board for new ideas and to receive input from them. The council had such a big impact that we soundly defeated Kansas State. Another problem was our location. Who ever heard of Provo, Utah? And who would ever want to go to school there? Who would want to go to a place where there was a lot of snow in the winter? We always used to pray for decent weather and no snow when it was time for recruiting visits. We finally decided to change our attitude and make the snow work for us instead of against us. Now we sell the snow. In fact, if there is no snow in town, we take our recruits a couple of miles up the canyon where there is some snow. We show them how much fun snow can be and how to enjoy the change of seasons. One of the first players we recruited was Mikeli Iramia, a young man from Samoa who played 1 year of high school football in New York. I remember the first time I saw him when he came to campus for a visit. A tall, thin, well-built, handsome young man with a ready smile. He was very nervous about coming into a new environment. And when we suggested going into the canyon to play in the snow, his eyes opened wide, his mouth dropped, and he said, "Coach, I have hardly ever seen snow, let alone play in it." We exposed Mikeli to skiing and snowmobiling that weekend. He had such a great time, he decided to enroll at BYU. The next 4 years, we had a tough time keeping Mikeli off the ski slopes and in the classroom. He loved it so much. However, he did graduate in 4 years, received his master's degree in public administration, and is now in Samoa working for a large corporation. It has worked for us, and there is a lesson here for people in most of life's endeavors. You can't hide the obvious, so try and make it work for you, not against you. There are 4 major schools in Utah, a state with only a little over 1 million people. That means there aren't enough good athletes to go around. So we faced a problem of where to recruit. We went to California and Hawaii. We rely heavily on California. That doesn't mean there are better athletes there, just more of them. We had a small stadium when I started, but a little success took care of that, just as a little success in business leads to expansion. In my time at BYU, our stadium has gone from 10,000 to 32,000 to 65,000 seats, and we sell out every game. In the beginning, we also faced a problem of limited administrative support. You know how that goes. The boss doesn't appreciate you, or won't give you enough salesmen or the equipment and facilities you need. I had only 6 assistant coaches while our competitors had the full staff of 8 that the NCAA rules allowed. After my first season, one of our defensive coaches left. In the process of finding a replacement, I located 2 outstanding defensive coaches who were both oriented toward working at BYU. Since we were already 1 coach short on the defense, I sold the administration on the idea that both men were outstanding coaches, and making a decision as to which one to hire was very difficult. Could we hire both? We had had a little more success that first year than was anticipated, so the climate was right, and they approved the request. The lesson here is that patience and a little success can solve a lot of problems. If, in the beginning, I had demanded more assistance, I probably would have been turned down, and this would have widened the gap between the administration and the football program. We had another unique problem at BYU. The Mormon religion encourages their young people to spend a certain amount of time doing missionary work. This takes them out of school for up to 2 years. It also takes them off the football field if they happen to be football players, and a lot of them are. In the old days, everyone assumed that players who served missions would never come back to play football, and if they did, they wouldn't be any good. In fact, our opposition felt sorry for us, because just about the time a player was ready for varsity football, he would be called to serve a 2-year mission. What did we do with that situation? We stayed in touch with the missionaries by writing to them regularly while they were gone. We saved their scholarship and encouraged them to return to play football after their mission. The result is that we have players coming back 2 years older, more mature, and usually wiser. Now our opponents don't feel sorry for us. Instead, they claim we have an unfair advantage because we are playing with a bunch of old men. What we did here was turn a unique problem into a huge plus. And we did it by simply letting the players who went on missions know that we cared about them and wanted them back. We encouraged the poor players to return just as much as we did the good players, and for good reason. No matter who you are, and no matter what your line of endeavor, nothing you will ever do is more important than letting those around you know you care for them and are concerned about their welfare. This builds a family atmosphere and makes for unity and breeds success. In 1973, Lance Reynolds started for us as a sophomore with the promise of becoming the best offensive lineman who ever played for BYU. After the 73 season, Reynolds was approached by his bishop about going on a Mormon mission for 2 years. Lance had always wanted to go on a mission. However, football was important to him, and he could see that he could have a great career as a player. At that time, people still believed that missions ruin football careers. Lance had a very difficult decision to make. After much soul-searching and prayer, he decided to go on a mission. I told Lance to go and be the best missionary he could be, and that I would have his scholarship waiting for him when he returned. He was a great missionary and served the last few months of his mission in the mission presidency, an honor not accorded many missionaries. When he completed his mission and returned to school and the football team, he found the transition period of getting ready, physically and mentally, very difficult. However, he stayed with it and became an all-conference lineman. He was drafted into the NFL, but an unfortunate injury kept him from playing pro ball. Today, Lance is a member of our coaching staff and is doing a great job. More than 2,500 years ago, Sun Tzu, a Chinese general, wrote a great book on military strategy. He said, "Regard your soldiers as your children, and they will follow you wherever you may lead. Look upon them as your beloved sons, and they will stand by you even unto death." The biggest problem I had when I became a head coach at BYU was how to win some football games. Coaches must be productive, just like you, in order to put food on the table. We have to meet the quota. Looking good is the bottom line. We all have to win. And how much and how often we have to win is usually determined by someone else. In the case of coaches, the alumni generally make the final decision. BYU had mainly been a running team, but with little success. I had to evaluate that and decide what we could do to win more often. I'm not a genius. On the contrary, I'm not ashamed to say I consider myself a plotter. I grew up on a farm, one of 14 children who were used to doing things the hard way. But I'm not afraid to take a chance, and I like to win. I decided that we were going to try to win rather than try to keep from losing. We weren't going to be so afraid of losing that we never got around to winning. I'm also able to face facts. I knew BYU couldn't consistently recruit the speed necessary for a great running game. California kids with great speed don't go to BYU. They go to Southern Cal or UCLA or somewhere else, not Provo, Utah. I couldn't see that we had any future trying to build a successful football team based on a running attack. I made the decision to throw the football. We would pass and pass some more. We would pass from any place on the field, and we would control the game by the pass. We would live by the pass, and maybe even die by the pass. I was committed to throwing the football. At the same time, I decided, like most coaches, that we would place great emphasis on defense so that we could get the ball. I also placed equal emphasis on our kicking game so we could get the ball in field position that would enhance the chances of our passing game. I hired an assistant coach named Dewey Warren from Tennessee to help formulate the passing game. The decision was made. Our goals were set. And, like anybody in any line of work who makes a tough decision and sets lofty goals, we had a difficult time sticking to the plan. In my first year, we had no passer, but we had a great running back in the program. So we did what came naturally. We built around him and won 7 games. At that point, it would have been understandable if we had lulled ourselves into thinking we could go on getting great running backs and winning with the run. But we stuck with our plan. The next year, we launched the passing game. And I wish I could tell you it was a thing of beauty, and we all lived happily ever after. It wasn't that way at all. We won 5 games and lost 6. I thought we made progress. Some of our fans thought we stunk up the place. It was our only losing year. In our 3rd year, we again were given every opportunity to question our decision to rely on the passing game. We lost our first 2 games, 15-13 and 9-6. Then, in the 3rd game, we were beaten badly. We had the 4th game won with less than 10 seconds to play, but we fumbled and our opponent recovered. They threw a touchdown pass and fortunately missed the extra point to tie us 33-33. If ever there was a time to give up, it was then. But we didn't. Instead, we won the next 7 games, won the 2nd conference championship in the history of the school, and went to the 1st bowl game ever for BYU. The rest is history. We missed a conference title in 1975, but won the next 10 straight conference championships, and in 1984, we won the national championship. We have stuck with our passing game, and we have averaged about 37 points per game with about 480 yards total offense per game. Those numbers will win most games, and that is what we've done. In the 80s, BYU has won more games than any other Division I school. You might say we play under something of a handicap when we take the field, because our opponents know what we are going to do on offense. We're going to pass. But I like to think that I know some other things that we're going to do. I like to think that we're going to try and try hard on every play, and that we're not going to give up, that we're going to maintain our poise, and that we're never going to leave the field, feeling that we didn't give it our best effort through the final down. Steve Young, our All-American quarterback during the 1982 and 83 seasons, is probably the greatest all-around athlete I have ever had the opportunity to coach. Steve is an unusually gifted athlete. In fact, Steve could play any one of 4 positions, quarterback, running back, wide receiver, or defensive back. He has good size, great speed, and great coordination. Although these qualities have helped make him into a champion and an All-American, it is his mental attitude that overshadows any other quality. 2 experiences illustrate my point. The first happened when, as a junior in college, Steve had his first starting assignment as a quarterback. We were playing the University of Georgia in Athens before 82,000 screaming Bulldog fans. It was a rainy day, and we were the underdogs. Georgia had won the national championship the year before, and Herschel Walker, their great running back, was returning. The first half of the game, Steve threw 5 interceptions, 3 of them deep in Georgia's territory. The turnovers not only resulted in our losing the ball, but also eliminating definite scoring opportunities via the field goal. Even with these turnovers, the game was tied at halftime 7-7. Going into the locker room, I thought it would be wise to get Steve off to himself and build up his confidence. I found a place where we were alone, and I began this great speech of how we must put the interceptions out of our minds and concentrate on the good aspects of the game so far. As I was getting ready to make this point, Steve said, "Coach, don't worry. There's no problem. I can hardly wait to get back out there the next half. We are going to win this game." I remember thinking to myself, "What do you mean there's no problem, you dummy? You have just thrown 5 interceptions in 1 half. Steve had a great second half, and we almost won the game. Georgia's Kevin Butler kicked a 45-yard field goal in the rain, against the wind, with few seconds remaining in the game, to ensure victory for Georgia. The next experience was against Ohio State that same season. We played in the 1982 Holiday Bowl and were soundly beaten by a strong Ohio State team. They were leading 47-17 with 45 seconds remaining in the game. Steve dropped back to pass. He couldn't find any receivers open and started to scramble, trying to find someone to throw the ball to. As he was running across the field, He was tackled from the blind side. The tackle was as hard a hit as I have ever seen. Steve had the wind knocked out of him and had to leave the game. We put in another quarterback. With a few seconds left in the game, Steve came to me on the sideline and said, "Coach, I've got to go back in the game." I told him no, because the game was totally out of reach and nothing could be accomplished with him going in for one play. Steve said, "Coach, they may win the game, but I don't want them to think they defeated us." With that, he ran out onto the field. I remember thinking, "Good luck." With time remaining for only one play, Steve dropped back and threw a nice pass over the middle for a completion. The final whistle blew and the game was over. Steve congratulated the Ohio State players and went to the locker room with his head held high, knowing he had given his best effort for the entire game. As I have thought about this experience, I think about some of the other players and what they were doing at the same time. Some were sitting on the bench with their heads in their hands. Others were making plans about what they were going to do after the game. In contrast, all Steve could think about was the game. He didn't quit until the final whistle. Is it any wonder that the next year he led our team to 12-1 record? In the process, he was a consensus All-American and later signed one of the largest contracts in sports history. I like the way Steve Young thinks. I believe that's probably the ultimate lesson of football, the lesson of never giving up, or never giving less than your best. It's easier to keep trying if you have a good chance to win, or if your goal is almost within your grasp. It's a lot tougher if you, and those around you, think you have little or no chance to win. We played Southern Methodist in the 1980 Holiday Bowl. SMU had two powerful running backs, Eric Dickerson and Craig James. With 3 minutes and 56 seconds remaining in the game, we were behind 45-25. In those last 3 minutes and 56 seconds, we scored 3 touchdowns, blocked a punt, executed a perfect onside kick, ran a 2-point play, and prevented them from making a first down. We did all of this with time running out. With 18 seconds remaining in the game, we blocked an SMU punt. With 3 seconds remaining, Jim McMahon completed a 50-yard Hail Mary pass to our tight end Clay Brown in the end zone. This made the score 45-45. With no time on the clock, Kurt Gunther, a walk-on place kicker, booted the PAT and we won the game 46-45. All of this was done with the thought of our 1979 Holiday Bowl loss to Indiana, where we were behind with a few seconds left and missed a field goal that would have won the game for us. The key to handling problems is to keep a clear perspective on the total situation. Recognize what is most important in life, and especially maintain a sense of humor. This will help us to realize the importance of having balance in our lives. I pride myself on being a hard worker, but I'm not a workaholic. I see too many coaches who believe if long hours are good, then longer hours are better. They tend to lose sight of what life was really all about. They become one-dimensional and often lose sight of the truly important aspects of their lives. When the pressure is the greatest and the problems are many, I think of a statement by Confucius that states, "This too will pass." I also step back and think of the things that are truly important to me in my life: my wife, my children, and my belief in God. These things are far more important to me than anything else in the world. When I do this, it does wonders for me. In 1972, my first year as a head coach, I placed so much pressure on myself that I honestly didn't think I would survive. Halfway through the season, I received a call from my high school basketball coach, Mel Briggs. He has been a great influence on me throughout my life. He told me that his 17-year-old son, Tommy, was dying of leukemia. Tommy was a great athlete and a leader in high school. Mel told me that Tommy wanted to see me. My wife and I drove to Salt Lake City to see Mel, his wife, and Tommy. I spent one of the greatest hours of my life talking with Tommy. He was so proud of me becoming the head football coach at BYU and of the early success we were having. He had no time for sorrow or regrets about his situation. Going home that night, I had a completely different perspective on what was truly important. Whenever we think we have problems, all we have to do is visit with the Tommies of this world, visit a jail, visit a crippled children's hospital, lose a loved one, or visit a nursing home. Such experiences will help us reevaluate our priorities. Remember, problems are normal. There will always be problems. Most are solved with cooperation and understanding, rather than with intimidation and confrontation. Simplify your life. Solve your problems by learning how to handle them. They won't go away, so face up to them. The sooner, the better.
Bo Schembechler began his coaching career as a graduate assistant to the legendary Woody Hayes at Ohio State. Upon becoming the head coach at Michigan in the tough Big Ten Conference, 17 of Bo's 21 teams at Michigan were ranked in the top 10 nationally. 17 of his teams went to bowl games. He's the winningest coach in Michigan football history and ranks 7th all-time in NCAA career victories. Upon retiring, Bo also served as athletic director at Michigan, and in his first year as athletic director, the Wolverines won the NCAA National Basketball Championship. He's now a highly sought-after motivational speaker. I know you will enjoy Bo's thoughts on winning. He believes that in order to win, you must be a realist. Bo Schembechler.
You know, there's a tremendous correlation with what you do, whatever it may be, and what I do as the head football coach at Michigan. There are certain fundamental principles that I think are absolutely essential for success. As you know, I deal with young men from 17 to 22 years of age, impressionable, smart, hardworking young men. The 1985 football season for me was one of the most gratifying that I've ever had since I've been at Michigan. It was a team that played truly as a team. And that, to me, was the most important single factor in our success. But let me go back a little bit so I can explain what had happened. One of the things that happens to an organization that's highly successful is that sometimes you become soft with success. I felt that happened to us in 1984 when we had the worst season that I've had at Michigan, when we won only half of our games. We made up our minds following that season that we were going to change our attitude and approach to the game as coaches, and that we were going to become much closer to our team than we ever had been before. I felt that was my shortcoming in 84. I didn't have a handle on this ball club. I wasn't as close to them as I had been in the previous years at Michigan. So I changed my attitude as well, and got as close to the players as I possibly could. We tried to sell them on one thing. We're going to play together as a team. No matter what happens, we're going to stay close, we're going to believe in one another, we're going to enjoy playing with one another, and we're going to win. We had no stars on this team. There were no preseason All-Americans. There was no one that you could point to that was going to be the great leader on our team. So we set up a program whereby every single senior on our ball club would have to take the responsibility for leadership of this team. We went into spring practice with a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of drive. The coaches were close to the players were having fun playing, and we were working harder than we ever had worked before. When we went into the season, we played the toughest schedule Michigan has ever had, and we opened with 3 consecutive victories, and that success catapulted us into a great season with a great deal of fun and a lot of victories. The real factor that was important for us was the team. When we played and someone on our team made a big play, everybody was delighted with his success. We jumped and congratulated him. We had a lot of enthusiasm because if I'm a player and congratulating another player for success, that sooner or later I'm going to make the big play and everybody's going to be enthused with my success. And success breeds success. And that's the way the season went for us. So coming off of that season, there were a lot of great things that happened. But I know this, if you're a successful organization, you can become soft with success too, and forget how you got there. And that is vitally important if you're going to be a successful organization. Leadership is the most important single factor. I learned that back in 1980 when I had an excellent football team that I thought should be a contender for the Big Ten and national honors. We opened the season that year against Northwestern and won by a close score. The second game was against Notre Dame. And Notre Dame came back in the last second, kicked a field goal to beat us. We came back home disheartened to play South Carolina at home and ended up losing that game. We had opened the season with two defeats and only one victory. Now, at Michigan, I want you to know, that is not considered a very good start. On our staff meeting on Sunday afternoon, one of my young coaches mentioned to me, he said, "You know, Bo, we got a problem on this team." And I said, "Yeah, well, what's the problem?" And he said, "We got a morale problem on this team." He says, "There's a lot of griping going on in the locker room and everything." I said, "Yeah, well, who's doing it? The guys that are playing or those that are sitting on the bench?" He said, "Coach, I heard it from the captain of the team." I said, "The captain of the team?" The captain of our team was a youngster by the name of Andy Canavino, wonderful football player. I said, "I'll give you 5 minutes to get Canavino in my office. I'm not one to let things drag on. If there's a problem here, I say we attack it now." So Canavino was brought into my office, and I sat him down and said, "Andy, you tell me we got a problem on this team." He says, "Yeah, Coach, I think we do." I said, "Well, what are some of the gripes going on?" He said, "Well, you know how it is. The guys are saying we're practicing too long. We hit too hard in practice, spending too much time in meetings, looking at too much film. Coaches are too critical. They're always honest. Every mistake, they get after us. Football isn't the fun used to be." And I said, "Andy, did you ever make any of those statements?" He says, "Yeah, Coach, I did." I said, "Andy, I want to tell you something. You're the captain of this team. That means that you represent me on the field. And that the on and off the field, that you have to be absolutely the leader of our team. If you're that kind of a guy, how in the world can you expect us to win and have great morale? I want you to tell all those players that have played at Michigan in the past, I would like to have you face them and tell them that we practice too hard and we hit too much, that we spend too much time in meetings, that football isn't fun at Michigan. And you know what they're all going to say to you? They're going to say you're a lousy leader, Andy Canavino." And Andy is an emotional Italian. And he stood up and looked at me, and he had a tear in his eye. And he said, "Coach, I know where you're coming from. It won't happen again." And he walked out the door. When Canavino left my office, I can honestly say to you, he became the greatest captain I've ever had at Michigan. He was captain of our defense. For the next 14 quarters, nobody crossed our goal line. Michigan began to win. And we won consecutively the rest of the games on our regular season. We went to the Rose Bowl, and we won the Rose Bowl. And as you well know, I haven't had a lot of teams that have been able to do that. But Andy Canavino, once he found out the importance of his role as a leader of our team, became the greatest captain I've ever had. I think it was my fault. I think that anybody who has any responsibility for leadership of people, who doesn't teach and coach attitude every single day, who isn't concerned about the attitude of the people that surround him every day, is destined for failure. But one who realizes that that is one of the most important single ingredients you can have in any organization to achieve any kind of success will find out that there are a lot of Canavinos out there. There are a lot of people out there who really do not understand what their role is and how important it is. And once they find out, they can really swing into action and become the great leader that Andy Canavino became for me. I think that's important. That happened to us in 1980. And then when we started to win again by 84, we softened a little bit. We didn't work as hard. We didn't have the same attitude. We didn't have the type of leadership that we needed to be successful. We had enough material to win in 84, and we didn't do it. So when 85 came around, we changed our ideas. We went back to what we knew was important and successful for us. And we had one of the greatest seasons that I've ever had, with some of the most amazing performances that we've ever had at Michigan. So those things, I think, are vitally important. The other thing that I think is important is that every individual that you have on your team or in your organization has got to set goals. That is vitally important. You cannot be successful today unless you know where you're going and what you want to achieve. And then when that happens, you don't let anybody talk you out of it. That is really important. You can't set goals too high. You may think sometimes they're unrealistic, but if you want to be a successful person or a successful athlete, you must not let people talk you out of what you want to do. I think the greatest illustration I've ever had of visualization and visualizing success was a player I had back in the early 70s. His name was Donnie Warner. Warner was a youngster who came into my office in the early summer, asked my secretary if he could speak to Coach Schembechler. She said, "Well, he's not too busy right now. Go on in." He walked through the door, this youngster who was about 5'10", 170 pounds, and came over and introduced himself to me and sat down. I said, "What can I do for you, young man?" He said, "My name's Donnie Warner. I'm from Divine Child High School in Detroit. I think you've heard of that school. We won the state championship this year." And I said, "Yes, I've heard of it. As a matter of fact, you had four outstanding players down there. Four guys who went to major schools on Grant and Aides. One to Michigan State, two to Notre Dame, one to Michigan." I said, "You know, I've seen a lot of that team, and I've looked a lot of film. I don't recall you in there. What'd you play, halfback?" He said, "No, I didn't play halfback. I played guard." I said, "Guard?" And he said, "Yes. And that's why I'm here. I've just been accepted in the School of Engineering here at Michigan, and I want to come out for football because my goal is to play football for you." And I said, "Well, that's a worthy goal, but, you know, I don't think we can allow you to do that. We just don't have anybody in our offensive line that weighs 170 pounds. He said, "Coach, I know that." He said, "But you spoke at our high school banquet, and you told everybody they could achieve anything they made up their mind to achieve. And so I made up my mind that when I came to Michigan that I was going to play football for you." And I said, "Geez, Don, that's really, you know, that's great, but I can't let you do it. I think you'll get killed playing in the offensive line for us." And he said, "You said that anybody who wanted to achieve success could do it." I said, "Now, wait a minute. You know who plays offensive guard at Michigan?" He said, "Sure, I do." I said, "Well, let me refresh your memory. The one left guard is Reggie McKenzie at 6'5", 250 pounds, All-American. The right guard is Tom Coyle, co-captain of the team, 6'3", 260 pounds, all Big Ten. Where are you going to fit in there?" He said, okay, then I'm too small to play offensive line. I'll play middle guard on defense." I said, "Son, middle guard on defense? You play middle guard on defense, those big guys are the guys that are going to block you." He said, "Coach, all I'm asking is a chance." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to give you one." And he said, "Then you're not the man you said you were. You said that anybody who wanted an opportunity, you'd give them one." I said, "Okay, you've talked me into it. I'll let you come out for football. But as soon as you realize that you're not big enough to play, I don't think that I'll hold anything against you if you come in and quit. Because really, I don't think you ought to be out there anyway." And he said, "Well, let's wait and see." So Donnie Warner came out for football at Michigan. And our defensive guys played him on the demonstration teams. Those are the guys that impersonate the defenses of the opponents we're going to play that week. And they would put him in for the last three or four plays of the practice. And honestly, he'd get knocked 10 yards off the ball. And really, if we played him all day, I think he probably would have gotten killed. But Donnie hung in there. After the season, I'm interviewing all the players. He comes into my office, and you got to understand, this kid is so motivated, so confident, that he's almost obnoxious when he talks to you. So he comes in and sits down. I said, well, Warner, I'm surprised you lasted the whole season. I think you've had enough. I think we've all realized that you really stuck it out there, but you can see you're never going to play football at Michigan. He said, Coach, I know what I have to do. He said, I got to get a little bigger, a little stronger. I'll hit the weight room. I'll work hard. I'll be back out in the spring. So Warner comes back out in the spring, and he plays again. He plays through his sophomore year. By the time he is a junior, he's up to 190 pounds. And Donnie Warner is a bright young man. When he lines up over the ball, he checks the stances of the men in front of him. He got to know our blocking scheme so well up front that very often he was in our backfield. I used to admonish our team and saying, well, if we can't block Donnie Warner, how are we going to block these Big Ten people on Saturday afternoon? And Warner then became a pretty decent football player. Too small, but he played a lot on the demonstration teams, did a pretty darn good job. At the end of his junior year, going into spring practice in preparation for his last season of football, both of our middle guards had graduated. So I told our defensive staff, look, and we opened the spring practice this year, I'd like to have you put Warner as the first string middle guard because this guy has done a tremendous job for us, and we ought to just give him the chance and reward him there a little bit. Let him in there for about 3 or 4 days and then get somebody big, young, fast in there to play ahead of him for the next season. Well, Warner comes out for spring practice, and he looks at the depth chart posted on the locker room wall, and he sees Donnie Warner at first string middle guard. He says to himself, well, they finally realized that I'm ready to play. So Warner had the audacity to think that he was going to be the middle guard for the 1973 season. And when we went out to spring practice, when we put him in there, he played with such great determination. He's so smart. Now he's quick. He's got pretty good arm and shoulder strength. He's not very big, but he knew what he was doing in there and where he was going, and he played an exceptionally fine spring practice. So at the end of spring practice, when I'm interviewing the players before they go home in the summer, Warner now swaggers into my office, figuring now he's a starter. And he begins to dominate the conversation with me as he usually does. And I had to say, now, Warner, how about shutting up for just a minute? Let me talk to you. I said, son, I think you had a great spring practice. I can't believe how well you played. If we were to start the season tomorrow, you'd be my starting middle guard. And on the basis of that, I want you to know that for the first time, I'm going to put you on grant and aid, and I'm going to pay all your way to go to Michigan next year. And this youngster looked at me and he said, well, well, well. Took me 3 years. But I knew damn well sooner or later I'd get some of your money. And so that's the kind of attitude that Warner had. And it was impressive because we came back out in 1973, had a great football team, went through the first 10 games unbeaten, untied. Our opponent in the last game of the year, as you know, is that great football classic against Ohio State. Ohio State's coming into Michigan Stadium. They're undefeated, untied. So this confrontation will determine the Big Ten Championship. It will determine who goes to the Rose Bowl. It could very well determine the National Championship. So this game is very, very big. Warner has had a great year for us. He's played extremely hard and well on a defense that played well all year. During the course of the week for Ohio State, you got to understand, there's a tremendous enthusiasm in our preparation. Everybody's very attentive. No one wants to make mistakes. Everybody knows who plays the hardest and makes the fewest mistakes will win this game. They have all 10 of our films. We have all 10 of theirs. During the course of the week between classes, our players come in and check that film and study their position so they know exactly what to expect. On Thursday afternoon, Warner came out of the projection room. He had studied all the films. He came up to me and he flicked an elbow into my stomach. And he said, Bo, got to understand he's calling me Bo now. He says, Bo, I've studied all the film. Ohio State has a great interior. That center's big and he is tough. But I want you to know, he is not going to single block me all afternoon. They're going to have to put two men on me, and when they do, you get those linebackers scraping off. And we'll shut down their running game. If we shut down their running game, you know they can't beat us passing. He said, that's the key to this game. I'll promise you this, they'll not block me alone. And I said, Donnie, I'm really glad I talked to you today because my confidence has zoomed. And so this game began. 105,000 people in the stands. Ohio State scored 10 quick points and went ahead. We came back the second half and tied the game at 10-10. Late in the game, Dennis Franklin, our fine quarterback, broke his collarbone and had to leave the game. And just following that, for the first time in his career, Donnie Warner went down with an injury. He had sustained a serious knee injury, and he was carried from the field. After the game, and the score was tied, we assumed that we were going to the Rose Bowl because Ohio State had gone the year before. Riding up to the hospital to be operated on, there was Donnie Warner in the back seat of the doctor's car with his leg propped up, and Dennis Franklin, the quarterback, sitting in the front seat with Dr. O'Connor and his arm strapped to his chest. And Donnie Warner says to Denny Franklin, when we go to the Rose Bowl, Larry Sipple will do a great job of playing quarterback for us. But who the hell's going to play middle guard? Donnie Warner, for the first time, was operated on. To this day, I consider him the greatest football player I've ever coached. He had no business playing football at Michigan, but he had such great desire to succeed. He set his goals so high. He was so stubborn, he was not going to let anybody talk him out of it. And that performance has carried over into his life. He now runs the computer program for the Ford Motor Company. He goes to school at Michigan so he can become an aeronautical engineer. Someday he'll probably end up in the space program because that's his ultimate goal. And anyone who thinks Donnie Warner isn't going to achieve that goal doesn't know how this young man thinks. What tremendous desire and how motivated he is. Because what he did in football, I've not seen in my career. And I've told this story many times, but it proved to me once and for all, if you make up your mind you want something, don't let anybody talk you out of it. Do everything you can to ensure that success. And there are a lot of Donnie Warners out there, if they just make up their mind, they want to be one. The things that I look for in our program, whether it's a player or coach or whoever it is, I want to be surrounded with people with the attributes that I'm going to mention to you now. If you want to be a football player at Michigan, there's certain size and skill that you have to have in order to compete. I think that's fundamental, except for one exception here and there, such as Donnie Warner, who has so many of the other attributes I'll speak about, that he was able to offset his lack of size, his lack of strength, with a tremendous attitude and other personal attributes that made him a successful football player and a successful man. The second thing I think you have to have is you have to be smart. You notice I didn't say intelligence. I said smart. You have to be smart enough to know what it takes in order to be successful. I want every football player at Michigan to realize his primary goal in being at that school is to get a degree. And that, above all else, has got to be his most motivating factor. The second thing is to play football. And if he wants to play on a team like Michigan, in an organization like this, he wants to be the kind of a guy who is success-oriented because he's playing in a program that has been successful and wants to continue to be successful. So I think being smart is important. Being smart enough to know what you have to do in order to succeed. If you're weak in one area, then you've got to offset it by being strong in others. And that, to me, is being smart. The third thing, and this is a bugaboo that usually ends up failure with some people, is a willingness to work. Do you realize what it takes in order to prepare a team or a player individually to participate on the Saturday afternoon game? There's a lot of dogged work done during the week, a lot of sweat, a lot of blood in order to prepare for that Saturday afternoon game. If you don't have that willingness to work, you can never be successful as a football player. It's no different than the guy out there who's going out to make a sale. You go out to make a sale and you get it, you've had success and you're elated. But the guy who is willing to do that work behind the scenes, dig out what is necessary to go in there to make that sale, hours and hours of preparation before he can go in there to play that game, that's the guy that's going to be most successful. And there are a lot of people out there that won't spend the time, that won't do that type of dirty work in order to go out there to be successful. I think that's important. A willingness to work. There is no place for laziness in any successful organization. And you can't have people that are just watching the clock to see if I put in my 8 hours and I'm on my way home. Because anyone who doesn't take work home with them, either mentally or physically, prepared to work extra hours, is not going to be successful. The next thing is you got to have highly motivated guys. You got to be guys that are going to set goals for themselves, that are willing to write them down, and to make sure that everybody knows exactly where they stand, where they're going, and what they're going to do. The motivated teams are the ones that are exciting to watch. The motivated player, you can tell. If you zero in on a motivated player, you'll see that every minute, every second that the game is going on, he's competing. And that, to me, is highly important. The highly motivated teams are the successful ones. The highly motivated individuals are the ones that are going to win. And you have to set goals, and you have to write them down, and you have to stick by them, and you cannot, under any circumstances, let somebody talk you out of what you want to be. The next thing is discipline. I think it's imperative that everybody has discipline in an organization. And I'm not talking just in terms of a team discipline, where you follow the rules and regulations of the team or the organization that you're associated with. It's a self-discipline, and one who can discipline himself to do the things that are necessary to be successful. Discipline himself to do that hard work, that behind-the-scenes things that are necessary to be successful. And disciplined enough to know what you can or cannot do in an organization, because you've got to understand that anything you do that is not in the best interest of society will always be a black mark on your organization. I tell every football player at Michigan that he is not a regular student at the university, because as soon as he violates the rules of our society, he'll end up with his name in the paper and on television, and that he's got to be different than the others, and he's got to act that way. And the same for the staff and the other people surrounding our organization. Every staff member in our coaching staff has got to understand that he has to be better than any faculty person in our university, because anything that he does to violate the rules is going to end up in the newspaper or on television where everybody can see what's going on. So that kind of discipline is absolutely essential. Character. I think that the only way that you can have a successful organization and that you can deal with the people around you is to tell the truth. Now, if you had an organization and you're dealing with people and everybody is leveling with one another, that we have created a mutual trust, then you have a great opportunity to be successful. I believe the greatest thing that you can ever say about an individual in any organization is that he or she will always tell the truth, and that you can always rely on what they've said. That, to me, is the most important single thing that I deal with in our organization. I'm sure it's important with everybody else, that you tell the truth and you develop a mutual trust. Attitude, we've talked about. How important an attitude is, and how the leaders of your organization have to be able to be great leaders in terms of attitude. How Andy Canavino became the greatest leader I've ever had, only because his own personal attitude was one that he was going to do everything he could to make sure that we were going to win. And to me, that is absolutely essential in any organization. The next thing is unselfish. There's so many people that want to be successful that they're thinking in terms of only their own personal success. The success of the team is still the most important single factor. It is in any organization. And when you see success of an associate of yours, you've got to be elated with that success, because sooner or later that success will be yours, and everybody will be congratulating you for what you have done. Unselfishness in an athletic team or in any organization that works together for success is absolutely essential. and the unselfish teams are the ones that have been the most successful. And then last but not least, I think loyalty is fundamental. Gripers and groaners and complainers are a detriment to any football team or any organization. I have always said this, and I know it's true. I want players at Michigan who are extremely proud to wear that unique headgear, who get a great thrill out of going down that tunnel onto the field before 100,000 people, just as all of their predecessors have in that great tradition of Michigan football. To me, that kind of loyalty is important. You can't have in an organization people who are constantly degrading and tearing down the things that that organization stands for. If you have gripes, you take it to your superiors. You tell them what you think. And if you can't live within the rules and regulations and operate within the organization the way it's set up, then you ought to leave. Because loyalty in any type of situation in which people are brought together for a common goal is absolutely essential. I believe that those attributes are the most important factors in a football program. And those that have had that type of leadership, that have had that kind of an attitude, have these kind of characteristics, are the ones that are most successful. There's no difference in that organization in athletics or in whatever organization you are a part of. If you have those attributes, your chances of success are great. Your chances of winning are going to be outstanding. Those are the important things that I think of.